Hi, everybody. My name's Ron. I'm an alcoholic. So I did take some notes just because I could get lost in this, because if you guys drink like I did, putting my story together in 40 minutes may not be the easiest thing, but just bear with me. If I get lost, I'll try to get back on track. My sobriety date is October 24th of 2013. So, you know, and that is a direct result of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and having a relationship with a living, loving God that I can do business with. So, man, I normally, like, I'm nervous as shit, you know. My Fitbit's saying I'm in cardio mode right now because my heart rate's so high. But I don't go out of my way to come up here and ask to speak. This isn't something that I do for fun, because standing up here in front of a group of people speaking is very uncomfortable. But I actually this time went out of my way to ask if I could come speak here, because, see, in 2012 and 2013, I came here to treatment. I was in these rooms. I was right where you guys were at, you know, those of you that are clients right now. I was full of fear, and I was hopeless, and I knew that I didn't want to die. And there were guys and women that came in here, and they shared their story, and they gave me that little bit of hope, you know. And I spent a lot of time in this room specifically because we had to go through all the shit that they make us do here, you know. So I know where you're coming from if you're here, and I hope today that I can give you a little bit of hope that, man, this thing, I have a life that I don't deserve today, you know. And it's through not just coming to treatment, but the fact that they gave me this little book and they took me to these meetings and they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not saying Alcoholics Anonymous is the only way to go, but it works for me, you know. Drugs are a big part of my story too. You know, they went hand in hand. But I try to respect the traditions of AA. And Alcoholics Anonymous in my hometown of Roswell, New Mexico, we're not a very big community, but AA is alive and well. You know, and I'm proud to say that because I am an active and healthy member of AA today. So I'd like to start with saying that I'm an alcoholic because I have the disease of alcoholism. So when I take a drink or whatever and I put that in my body, I don't know if or when I'm going to stop. I don't know how far I'm going to go with it, you know. There's been times that I put it in my body and I was able to do what I needed to do, but there's been a lot of times that I couldn't stop and I couldn't control what I wanted to do. So not along with the physical allergy that the book describes, but I have that mental obsession to where I've quit lots of times, but I can't stay stopped. You know, sooner or later I'm going to pick up that drink unless I have that mental defense that comes from a higher power, and that's what the book tells me. So I'm going to do my best to tell this to the best of my ability of the way that I remember. I also have this disease of perception, like I remember things the way I want to remember them. So, like, the people that are in the room with me tonight, my two boys, 14 and 16-year-old, Jade and Hunter, my stepdad, my mom, and my sister over there, you know. So, like, going along with the truth of my story, I'm going to tell you how I remember it, because that's how it's true to me. But they may know a little different than I do. Because, see, going back and doing these amends that the book requires me to do, I have found that my part was a little different than the way that I remember it. And I'm cool with that, because I'm open to learn, you know. So I'd like to share my first drink. The first drink that I remember taking on my own power, like my own choice, I was probably 10 years old or so. It was at my grandmother's house. It was for an anniversary party. And we snuck into the ice chest and got some beer and some wine coolers and whatever else we'd get a hold of. And we went, and it was out in the country in New Mexico there, and we went to an irrigation ditch and we popped them open. It was my younger cousin and one of his friends. And we went back and we got a few more, you know, and at that time, I don't remember getting sick. I don't remember any major effects from it the next day. I just remember I liked the way it felt, you know. And there was a couple years that went by before I took a drink again. My first drunk, which pretty much turned into a blackout, mom, sorry, but this is the one I remember. My dad went out of town and my mom was going to let my sister and a few friends come over and have some drinks as long as they stayed at the house. And so she let me too. And I don't know if she was trying to teach me that, you know, alcohol is not really going to be my friend if I abuse it. But I remember drinking as much of I could get a hold of. And you know, within a few hours that night, probably 13 years old or so, I was falling down the hallway drunk, you know, hitting my head on things, and I had to have help get to my room. And I was fucking sick for 3 days afterwards. And I remember thinking, I'm never going to do this shit again. This is miserable. Yeah. Go ahead a couple, maybe about a year. I remember standing outside of a grocery store. And see, back then, it wasn't as big of a deal. I know I'm 37 today, so it's not too long ago. But we stood outside the store, and we were finding somebody that would walk in to the grocery store and go in and buy us some booze, you know, and we gave him some money, gave him some extra money for some smokes and talked somebody into it. And it wasn't real hard to do. I remember they got us, they came out with like a 12-pack of Zima, and that probably dates me a little bit, but I remember my friend drinking maybe three of them, and I finished the rest, you know, and I remember that night, that feeling of like, there was a girl down the street that I had never had the courage to talk to. I remember feeling like I was okay that night, and I did some things that I normally wouldn't do. I busted my head open, and this is what I was told, plus there was, I mean, obviously a cut on my head, but I blacked out, and I don't remember. And, you know, and that obviously didn't stop me from doing what I did. My high school was pretty much, I was a good student, man. I had friends. I was in honors classes. As soon as I was old enough to get a job, I got a job. I took care of my responsibilities on the outside. I was in sports. I was active. But I also liked to party, you know. I remember the first time I smoked weed, I thought, man, this is it. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. This makes work better. It makes school better. It makes, you know, hanging out more fun. It makes relationships easier. It was my escape. It's how I felt like I could fit in. And, you know, through high school, I tried just about everything. I can't say I was drinking every day back then because it wasn't as easy to get. I mean, it was possible, but we usually had to do it on the weekends. But I do remember probably towards my junior year, because I had started getting some of those other outside issues that go hand in hand with alcohol so you can drink longer and stay up a little later. Mine at that time was cocaine. I'm just thinking, man, even at the end of the night, there's something different about the way I'm doing things compared to my friends. And they were partying, you know? I mean, we would go do what we did, but I was always going just a little farther and a little harder. You know, come on, let's go one more. You know, I'll go buy another 20, whatever. You know, let's do this. And so that's how my high school went. I didn't get in a whole lot of trouble. I got arrested at the age of 18, and I got out of it. I mean, the night that I turned 18, I got busted for possession of cocaine, and I got out of it, you know. So I never really had any major effects that got my attention, obviously. But that's kind of how my high school was. You know, I knew there was something a little different about me, but I was absolutely willing to keep chasing this thing. I met a girl, and she is the mother of my two boys, and we are not married today, but her and I have an amazing relationship, you know. And we never had that relationship when I was still drinking and using. But through Alcoholics Anonymous and this gift that I've been given, I mean, the relationship that we have is just, it's unreal. Because I get to tell her the truth today, and we get to work together to be parents of our two boys. We got married, and I love to cook. I've always loved to cook. And I had this idea that I wanted to go to culinary school. So we moved to Portland, Oregon. And I enrolled in school up there, and it wasn't too long of being up there that she got pregnant with my oldest son, and we did what we did. I mean, you know, back then she liked to smoke and she liked to drink, not like I did, but, you know, she put up with me while I did what I did. And I remember I wasn't even 21 yet when I moved up there, but being in culinary school, I don't know if anybody's got experience in restaurants. Booze and drugs, I mean, I know they're everywhere, but it just seemed like they were heavier in the food service industry. And especially at school, like, if you wanted booze, there was cooking wine, there was stuff to cook with. I mean, it wasn't hard to get it. And so every day, that's when I realized that my drinking had become a daily thing. We would have quart containers that we stored food in, and that's what they let us drink our sodas out of, and we'd mix Sprite with cooking wine or whatever, you know, and that was just a daily thing. The guys I hung around with were a little bit older, and so every day we got out of school, we were buying, you know, a four-pack of Miller High Life or whatever, and I mean, and that's just how it went. And see, my thing was, the way I felt was, I knew I was doing it a little bit different. I knew there was a problem with the way that I drank and I did drugs. But I felt like if they would just mind their own damn business, you know. And I didn't really have a lot of people onto me about my shit then. I mean, I was 2,000 miles away from my parents. The only person there was my ex-wife. And then my friends that were in school with me were doing the same shit. So it's like I had two jobs. I was going to school full time. I wasn't cheating on my wife. You know, I was paying the bills. I can do what I want, right? I can put this shit on in me if I want to. I'm showing up to work. I'm kicking ass at school. I graduated number two in my class. I mean, from the outside, it's like things were good. Nobody could tell me that I wasn't doing okay. But I know, looking back today, that that's kind of where that invisible line that I crossed over, you know. I always felt like there was something different, but that's when I realized, man, I got a problem. You know, I drink a little more than I should because I was drinking during the day, and I was drinking some mornings whenever I did a little bit too much the night before. I got to share a story about when my son was born. He was born right outside of Portland in a town called Hillsboro. And the only person that was up there at the time was my ex-wife's mother. She came to stay with us during the end of the pregnancy when he was going to be born. And the morning that he was born, I remember it's like 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. As soon as the store opened up, I went down there and I bought a couple tall boys. And I went out by the dumpster in the outside of the hospital by myself. And I chugged these two tall boys, you know. And I look back at that today and I'm like, that's just not normal, you know. I didn't get wasted, but there was just that mental obsession. I just can't stay quiet. I mean, why am I skipping out of this time with my son when this is like one of the most memorable times of my life to go out and have a drink? You know, in my head, I justified, well, I'm celebrating. My son was just born. I don't have anybody else here that drinks like I do, so I can't take it into the hospital with me. You know, anyway, I look back today, and it's like I gave up a lot of my kid's life to chase drugs and alcohol. You know, it sucks, but it's the truth. And I can't get any of that time back. But, you know, through practicing the 12 steps and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's not a day that goes by that I don't disappoint those kids anymore. You know, when I drop them off, like that fear that I used to see in their eyes, it's not there. Like, I really get to be a dad today through this thing. I graduated school. Hunter was about a month old. We drove back. Her family was in Dexter, which is a little bit right by Roswell, and my family was there. And we decided we were going to come back. I wanted to start a catering business, and got back to Roswell. You know, my drinking and my using never slowed down. It was full on. I found jobs. I was working, and I actually started doing some caterings on the side. So I was pretty busy. Before I had left, when I was still in high school, I was introduced to meth. Back then, we called it crank. When I came back, it seemed like something happened, and the shit that I was getting now was called ice, and it was just, like, phenomenal. Like, it blew me away when I did it. And before I knew it, I was using that shit on a regular basis. See, when I first picked it up, it was a tool that I thought I was using because I needed to stay up a little longer. I needed to be able to get my extra shit done. I was working a full-time job, and I was trying to do caterings in the evenings. And, man, I mean, I really thought that I had found something that was going to help me be successful. And, shit, man, that stuff grabbed a hold of me like no other. You know, alcohol's always been a part of my story. But, see, today, the mental obsession to drink's been removed. I can be around people that are drinking. I don't like being around drunks, but I can be around people that are drinking. I don't go to places that alcohol's being served unless I have a legitimate reason to be there. And most of the time, I take somebody with me. But I don't put myself in dope houses anymore. I can't be around that shit. I can't see somebody stick a needle in their arm on a fucking movie. Like, that, it gets me to a point where I'm not good. That's just my story. That's the truth. But, so when I got back, when we were back in Roswell, the ice thing, like, took off with me. I was still drinking. Got pregnant again. So I got my other son here, Jaden. He was born in Roswell. And I remember being at the hospital and seeing a lot of this is extremely blurry, but there's points that I do remember. But I remember being at that hospital, and I remember fiending because I hadn't had anything in a couple days because I was at the hospital with my ex-wife and waiting for my son to be born. And as soon as he was born and things were okay, okay, let me run to the house and go get you this. Let me go get what you need. I'll be right back. And I mean, what did I do? I made an excuse to go score dope. And I got what I needed, and I went back, you know. And I can't remember his birth, you know. I can remember Hunter's, but I can't remember my other son's. I was not thinking about his birth. I was thinking about, I need to score some fucking dope, you know. And that's just how it was. And those things progressed pretty good because the people that I hung around with, the people I associated with, were all dope heads, you know. And I ended up getting arrested for possession because I got caught buying from a dope house that was being watched, and they pulled me over for no tags or expired tags. And I'm really good at, when I get under pressure, to get the pressure off me. I do what they want me to do for a little while, you know, just to stay under the radar. So I was on probation. I actually had to quit the job I was at. It was kind of a mutual agreement. They didn't want me being there, and I knew I couldn't work there anymore because I got caught with a possession. But I was on probation, and I had to take drug tests. But they didn't check me for alcohol. Like, they weren't worried about the alcohol for some reason. So my drinking totally picked up, and I put down the outside issues, and I only did them on the rare occasion that I knew I wasn't going to take a test for a week. And I did what I do. I manipulated. I showed up to probation. I told them, you know, I'm doing the right thing. I showed them I was doing the right thing. I mean, I just stayed out of their business. I mean, like, I didn't bring any attention to myself. I didn't fail any urine test. But as soon as that day came, I was already planning. When my probation was over, it's on, you know? And so I always had that dream to have the catering business. And during this time that I quit this last job, an opportunity presented itself where this guy was selling his catering business. And I pulled some resources together. I got with my mom. I took a little loan. I got with my dad, and we got some money together, and I bought this business. It was already established. And this was all through that probation period. So I was putting a lot of effort into this business, and I was actually pretty successful. I mean, I loved to cook, and people could see that, and they loved to buy my food, and they loved to hire me. But man, when that's not the forefront of things, when the dope like is and the drinking is the forefront of all that stuff, my business was, I mean, it was set up for failure. I think that business could have went really far if I was doing it today with practicing the principles that I do in my life. And that may be a possibility for me one day. I don't know. But anyway, so I completed probation, did what they wanted me to do. I had this catering business going, got right back into it, started using the needle. I hadn't touched the needle yet. And things went really downhill. My marriage was going to shit. I was obviously not home. I was using the excuse of, well, I need to stay up at their catering business. I need to cook. I need to do this. I got stuff ready for tomorrow. I got it, whatever. My priorities were not my ex-wife and my kids. And they definitely weren't my business. The only thing I needed my business for was to make enough money to do what I needed to do. And so my marriage was going to shit. My ex-wife saw it. And she basically said, we need to separate. And my catering business basically closed down in that process because, I mean, I was just spending everything that I had on it. And within a couple months, she filed for divorce. She came over with some papers that said, I don't want you to have any custody of the kids until you get your drug and alcohol problem fixed. And I signed that over without a question. You know, I remember that day because I signed the rights to my kids over. You know, and I was just like, because I knew what I was doing. And I had told her, look, I don't want to be this person, but I'm not stupid enough to ask somebody for help. You know, that's the way I felt. Like, I don't need help. I can figure this shit out on my own. But I signed the divorce papers. I signed it over, and I went through a pretty dark spot. Through the process of the way that I was living, my jobs were pretty scattered. I constantly worked, but it was like as soon as they were finding out the real me, you know, I would go to another place before they fired me. When they were starting to smell the alcohol on me when I showed up or I missed a day of work, you know, I don't know if you've ever experienced that, but I got a new job before I got fired from the last job, and I bounced around and I did what I had to do. Because, see, I'm really good at putting on a nice dress shirt and walking in and telling somebody, hey, I'm really a valuable asset. If you hire me, I'll do this, this, and this. And I actually kick ass when I'm there, but getting me there and having me not be so under the influence that I can't perform is, that's hit or miss, you know. So through that process of job after job, I knew deep down that I wanted to be a part of my kids' lives. I knew it. I absolutely knew in my heart that I loved them more than I loved myself, and I wanted to be part of their life. And so I was hiring an attorney, and I was going to try to get my visitation revised, and he sprung this random hair follicle test on me because, see, my ex-wife knew that all the jobs I had gotten required a drug test prior, I knew how to pass UAs. There's ways to do it, and I knew how to do that. And so a hair follicle test was something I didn't know how to get around. And when they sprung that on me without me knowing and I tested positive, I just said, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to move to San Antonio because my mom's over there, and I'm going to make this geographical change, and I'm going to search out this chef thing because I haven't been able to really do it in Roswell. And I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to get away from the problem because the problem is Roswell. You know, the problem is my ex-wife. She's the one that won't let me be a damn father to my kids. She's the reason I don't get to see them. That's not the way I feel today, but let me just say that nothing changed in San Antonio because you know what? Wherever I go, there I am. You know, my problem is me. It's not where I live. It's not the outside stuff. So I did what I do here. And then I got miserable here. And I decided to move back because I really wanted to be around my kids again. Because see, this whole time, like, I want to be this father that I know that I can be. Like, I know what's inside me. I just don't know how to get there. So got back to Roswell, trying to do this thing. I actually put down the drugs. Didn't touch them for a while. I started doing the hair follicle test. I was letting my hair grow out. They would test it, clip it, shave my head, do it again. Every 90 days, I was going back and doing it. And slowly, my ex-wife was allowing me to start seeing my kids again. Because, see, they didn't care about the alcohol. It was legal. It was just the drugs that they wanted me to show that I was doing okay from. And I can tell you, though, my drinking was so bad then, like, I remember waking up in the mornings or coming to so shaky that I would have to take a drink and literally shake and spill the drink. As soon as I got the drink in my system, I would vomit because I couldn't hold it down. When I finally got enough in me that it started to take the effects that alcohol does and it quiets the nerves a little bit, I would drink a little bit more and I would start my day that way. You know, and that's how I did things. And I can remember the smells, I can remember the exact place of where I was. And I knew that I'm putting this poison in my body and I'm killing myself because of the amount that I'm drinking. But if I don't drink it, I feel like I'm going to die. So it's like I'm in this place where I don't know what to do. I am fucking miserable. And I got an opportunity to work for the Roswell Fire Department. I went in there here like just on a whim. I showed up. I did their physical test. I mean, I do what we do. I went to freaking Red Lobster the night before and had like 12 beers and ate all-you-can-eat shrimp and, you know, and went to this tryout the next morning, which is a pretty intense physical tryout. And I kicked ass, and I went and did the written test, and I kicked ass, and I was like number two out of like, I don't know, 60-something applicants, and they gave me a job, you know? And my drinking was as bad as it's ever been. So, I mean, this is how it works for me. Sooner or later, they're going to find out, because I can't stop drinking. You know, no matter how good the job is, no matter how good the relationship with my kids is, no matter what opportunity or girlfriend or whatever I have in my life, I can't quit for that. So 6 months into my job, I decided to go celebrate because I had just passed my EMT basic or something like that. We finally finished the fire school. I don't remember. And my intentions were not to drive that night. But I ended up getting alcohol in my body. And see, like I said, I put a couple in me and I got this great idea that this is all I'm going to do tonight. And once those hit me, that physical allergy kicks in. And it's like, that was a bad idea. I'm just going to keep drinking, you know, because that's all I know. My body craves more alcohol as soon as I drink some. And I got pulled over that night for a DUI. And there wasn't anything I could do. My job was gone. I was on a probation period with the fire department. There was nothing that they could do. So they had to let me go. And I go right back into my old ways, job after job, doing what I do, you know. And this one job that I was working at, actually, the boss drank like I drank. And so I could actually show up there hungover. I could have a few drinks in the morning before I went in because we both still smelled like alcohol. So I was able to kind of do what I wanted to do without being caught. And or he just didn't care, whatever. But as I was working there, man, that spiritual malady that's building up inside of me, and I didn't know what it was back then. I know what it is today. But back then, it was just building up, and I was hating myself more and more. And I wasn't real happy with the job I was at. I was getting minimal visitation with my kids. But the fact is, even when my kids were around, I was so obsessed about only drinking a little bit, and as soon as I dropped them off, I can drink like I want to. So it's like all those days that I got to visit with them and have them around, I can't even remember. The only thing I was thinking about was fucking drinking, you know? So I had a doctor that came with an idea through a mutual friend that he wanted to open up a sushi bar. And he found out that I had culinary experience, and he couldn't find a sushi chef to move to Roswell. I don't blame him. He's had trouble keeping them since, but, you know, it is what it is. And there was no sushi places in Roswell before this place opened. But anyway, we got together, and I thought, man, here's an opportunity to get the fuck out of Roswell again. I'm going to make this geographical change. I'm going to go to L.A. He was going to pay for the school. He was going to give me a little bit of money, and I just had to pay my way while I was there. So I got the cheapest hotel I could find. We got this thing all ironed out, and I went over there. And I'll tell you what, man, wherever I go, there I am. Except now, nobody knows me, so I can drink like I want to. There is nobody watching me, no family, nothing. So I'm in this shitty-ass hotel room where the next door, they're like renting it out by the hour, if you know what I mean. There's some stuff going on over there. I found a used syringe up above the vanity in the bathroom, you know. And it's a really ugly place when you look at that and think, I wonder if there's anything on that if I could use it. I didn't, but the thought went through my mind. But when I'm in, it was actually in Torrance, it's right outside of L.A., when I'm going to school there, I had a friend, I reached out. I knew I was miserable. Because see, about a month into being there, I got this hotel about a freaking block and a half, maybe a little bit farther than that, from where my school was at. Because, see, I've already experienced a lot of things with driving under the influence. And if I can avoid driving at all costs, I can get fucked up all I want, right? So I got that hotel based on where I was going to be located. And, you know, I walked to school. And as I would leave school, because I had to be there at 7, nerves are pretty bad. You know, I tried not to drink before school. When I was leaving school at 12 to 1 o'clock every day, I would stop by this same little corner stop. And after about a month of it, this guy's, one of the store owners there, was just like, dude, what's wrong with you, man? You are killing yourself. And I'm just like, whatever, you know? I mean, I guess I'll go find another store. You know, I mean, he's only seen me there for a month, and he's like, you're young, man. Why are you got a future ahead of you? What the fuck are you doing? I'm just like, well, it looks like I got to find somewhere else. And, you know, that's what I do. One of the things that happened that's pretty significant, and I like to share this, is because it's important today, because it's not what I do today. I was introduced to this book. A friend of mine that was going to school with me somehow looked up Alcoholics Anonymous. He was from overseas, and just going there just for that school. He actually took the effort to take me to a meeting, gave me this book. I remember being at the meeting. I don't remember anything that went on. I remember getting the book. I never opened it. I remember being told you should get phone numbers. I got a phone number. I didn't use that phone number. I never called anybody. I never read the book. I never took any action. So nothing changed, you know? Also, during the time that I was in Torrance going to school, one morning I was running late because I had been at the bar till like 3 o'clock. And I got up that morning and I knew I had to drink something. And I drank vodka like I drink vodka. And it's basically like you pour a half a Gatorade out, pour a pint of vodka in, and drink it. And I decided, you know what, I'm just going to drive today because it's just down the street. And in that short little period, I rear-ended somebody and got a DUI there. So I'm in Torrance. I got about a month left of school, and I've got this DUI that's going on. And I remember calling the courts, and I tried to get some things done, but it hadn't even processed through the system yet. So I'm just kind of like, you know what, I finished my school out. Barely. I missed the maximum of 3 days that you can miss in the 2 months of the school. And I went back, and I came back to New Mexico, and I never did anything about the DUI. And I just figured, you know what? I'm not going back to California for anything, so screw it. One of the first things I did is I went and checked my driving record to make sure my license from New Mexico was still valid, if they put a suspension or a hold on it, and they hadn't. So I'm like, you know what? whatever, you know, California can kiss my ass, I'm not going back. And there's a story that goes along with that too that I'm going to try to get into. But so this is what happens for me with untreated alcoholism. I got into the sushi place. We were going balls to the wall to get this place started. He wanted to be open 7 days a week. I was the only chef. Basically, I was the only one doing any of the food part. And it wasn't a big place, but we got pretty busy because it was new, and there was nothing else that had sushi in Roswell. And I was working 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. I was on salary, and I was working for tips. And, I mean, the money thing's not a big deal, but the fact of being there for 14 hours and not being able to leave to go get a drink, not being able to bring in enough with me, there was days I couldn't drink. I literally couldn't drink. And when I got home, I was so physically tired that, like, I couldn't even drink enough before I passed out, like, actually tired. But that, to me, what I know of that today is that's untreated alcoholism. I was going fucking crazy inside my head because I could not get my solution. See, the one thing that I've learned is drugs and alcohol weren't my problem. They were the solution to my life. And I couldn't find my solution, and I was searching for something, you know? But what happens with a guy like me that drinks like I drink is I finally got an opportunity to drink, and I got drunk, and I didn't show up to work because that's how it goes. That happened twice, and he said, look, we're going to have to part ways. And he had not even hired anybody else to help relieve me, you know, like we were trying to get another chef to get in there. Whatever. I mean, it is what it is. I can see my part in that thing today. When I left there, I went back to the same job that I was at that allowed me to drink like I wanted to drink. And at that point, I was so miserable. You know, the book talks about trying to switch up the way we drink. I not only did that, but I tried to stop in every way that I possibly could. I had been an EMT, so I tried to have people come over and give me IVs so I could detox myself. If you name it, I probably came up with a way to try to stop drinking, to detox myself. And there was a few times I made it through a weekend and actually felt a little better. You know, enough vomiting, enough shaking, enough nightmares, enough of all the stuff that goes on whenever I'm withdrawing from alcohol. But I would always pick back up. And this comes to the point of my son's, how old were you in 2012? Yeah, I am a good dad, I think. But my son's birthday was going to be September 11th. And so I was sick and tired of living the way that I was living. I've already told my sister and my family that I don't want to keep drinking the way that I'm drinking, but I had never really reached out for help. So I decided to do what I know how to do, and that's detox myself. And I went through that weekend, and I shook, and I vomited, and I had nightmares, and I sweated. And I made it till like Sunday afternoon, and finally I was feeling a little better. And Monday rolled around. And see, throughout this whole process, my ex-wife obviously did not trust me with my kids alone because of the way that I had lived, you know. So she was going to let me take my son to dinner. And I think it was actually the day before his birthday. So it would have been September 10th. She dropped him off, my other son off, and I was there with my nephew. And I came up with this idea. Well, I made it through the weekend. I'm going to go to my house and change in my own clothes over there and take a shower in my shower, and I'm going to get cleaned up, and we're going to get ready for dinner. And this was probably like 1 or 2 in the afternoon. We were going to go to dinner at like 6. So this idea comes to my head as I'm driving over there. Man, a half a pint of vodka would sure make it easier to eat, because I know if I try to eat right now, I'm going to throw that shit up. I can't eat food whenever I'm withdrawing like that. So that's what I did, because it always works. And I get the Gatorade, and I pour it out, and I pour the half a pint of vodka in, and I drink it. And, you know, and I'm probably choking it down because I am literally trying not to throw it up as I'm drinking it. And I go to my house, and I get that alcohol in my body, and you know, I get that sense of ease and comfort that comes after a few drinks, especially just like that. And I start to feel a little better. And I take the shower, and I get cleaned up, and I'm thinking, man, I got some hope. I can make it through this dinner tonight. But see, here's the problem that I didn't know at the time. That's when the physical allergy kicked in. I'm right back to the store. Well, that worked. Let me try a little more. Maybe I'll feel a little better, and I'll actually be able to actually really eat something. So I go buy 2 pints like I do, and I buy some Gatorade like I do. And those two boys were witness to this, and I don't remember much of it. But they got to see me drinking that second pint straight out of the bottle. I was wrestling with my nephew and being rougher than I should have been. He was crying. I was falling down all over the place. I was like blacked out, insanely drunk. And they had to call an ambulance to come get me to take me to the hospital because they were afraid that I had drank too much, you know. And I understand, you know, and my ex-wife had to be called yet again to come get the boys because I did what I do. And see, that is my experience. That is exactly what happens every time I pick up a drink. Even with the best intentions, man, I've got my son's fucking birthday to go to. She hasn't let me see him, and I don't know how long, and I'm going to... That's just how alcohol works for me. I come to in a hospital bed. I'm not handcuffed. I have IVs all in me. It's like 2 in the morning, and I'm like, I don't even know how I got here. I start thinking a little bit, and I remember being at my sister's house, so I call her first. And she answers the phone, and she tells me what happened, and I kind of get the image of I remember a little. So at this time, I had been seeing a psychiatrist. He had prescribed me some medications for my depression, you know, because if you're like me, I wanted to feel better, but I wasn't willing to stop drinking. And, you know, you go to a psychiatrist and you tell them what they want to hear, not the truth. They're going to prescribe you with these things to make you feel better. And he showed up over there and he kind of gave me the ultimatum. Look, you can either walk out of the hospital or you can go to Sunrise. And Sunrise in Roswell, it's at our hospital there, and it's a mental health facility. I mean, it's a place where you don't just go for drugs and alcohol, but you go for mental health problems. And it is a vacation that I hope I don't have to take again, you know. So anyway, I go in there, and they detox me, and the idea comes up to go to treatment. And I'm at this point where I'm like, I know if I leave here, I'm going to go drink again. I have proven it over and over and over. And so my dad offers, because see, there's a rehab in Roswell. I could go to Roswell, and it doesn't cost very much money, but I was too afraid to go there because I didn't want anybody to find out that I was going to go get treatment. So we found this place. My mom actually looked it up. And I'm so grateful for Austin Recovery because, you know, to me it's not about the treatment center, but it's about what they did with me while I was here and what they introduced me to. And they gave me a little big book, and they took me to meetings, and they gave me some suggestions. And anyway, my hats are off to Austin Recovery for that. But I made that decision, let's do it. You know, otherwise I'm going to die. And one of the first things that I remember showing up here was I got out of the van after going through the intake part. And I remember even in the intake, like, this is me. They're asking me these questions about how much I drank and how much I used and how often and this and that. I didn't tell them the truth. I told them what they wanted to hear. I was truthful in some areas, but I never, like, at that time, I wasn't even willing to admit to them I'd stuck a needle in my arm because I didn't want to be looked at as one of those people, you know. And when I got here, the van doors opened, and I walked inside, and there was a group of guys that gave me a bunch of hope, you know, and they welcomed me, and they shared some stuff about, like, the way that they drank and the way that they used, and it made sense to me. And then they gave me this big book. And I'd had one before, but I never opened it. And I actually took the time and got up in the morning and started to read this thing. And I fucking identified in this book. And I'm like, you know, these two old guys, like, what would I have in common with them? But the way they talked about, the way that they drank, the way that they felt, the things that they did, you know, what alcohol did to them and for them, I got it. I went through treatment here, and I did everything that they asked me to do. I wasn't one of the guys that acted out or snuck out. I stayed under the radar, you know. I made my bed in the morning like they asked. I cleaned. I went up the extra effort. I tried to help with chairs, whatever, you know. I went to meetings. I remember at the time Keith was my counselor, and I remember talking to him, but I remember not being honest, you know. And then they made these suggestions when you get out of treatment. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Get a sponsor. Work the steps, you know. You've got to take care of your recovery. And I remember leaving treatment, and I had a whole lot of self-knowledge. Like, I felt like I knew a lot more about me and this disease that I had. Because at that time, I could fully concede to my innermost self I was alcoholic. But I hadn't given up that manageability of my life yet. Because I still thought I could do things on my own and figure them out on my own. And when I left treatment, I went to my mom's house. And see, my mom is a non-alcoholic. And I find that they can actually get a prescription, a pain prescription, and not take the whole thing. And so when I got over there, I'm not thinking about using. I mean, I hadn't got it honest yet, but I'm not thinking about using anything. But I see this pill bottle, and I'm like, shit, they're 7 years old. Let me try one, you know? And I can sit here and tell you, I didn't feel high. I didn't get any effect from it. It was a Vicodin 5, so it was like real small, you know? I mean, one of the ones that don't really work for me anyway. And I put that in my body, and I went to a meeting because they told me as soon as you get out of rehab, go to a meeting. And I went and picked up a 30-day chip there, but I never got honest. I didn't tell anybody that I had just fucking taken a pill. You know, and then I carried that with me when I went back to Roswell. And I did exactly what they told me to. You get off the plane, you go to a meeting before you even go home. I did that. You know, there was some of the stuff that I was doing, but I hadn't really given it all. And within 90 days, I had been to 90 meetings. I had gotten a sponsor. I found somebody that I could relate to, somebody that drank and used drugs like I did, and somebody that wasn't just happy in the rooms, and he's extremely happy. Like, this guy goes out of his way to hug everybody. And, man, he really had something that I wanted. And but I was not willing to get honest with him. You know, we went through steps 1, 2, and 3, and I really didn't have a problem with God. I just had never really tried to have a relationship with God. And when it came to that fourth step of, man, I've got to make this searching and fearless moral inventory, and I've got to get honest about this shit that I've done in my life. Nope. Sorry. I remember being in that intake chair with Keith, and I'm like, I am not going to tell everybody or anybody everything. That is not going to happen. This is going to be between God and I when I get to that point. And I held on to that stuff. I never went past pen to paper on the fourth step. And so my untreated alcoholism gets worse because I'm not taking anything as a solution to life. See, on the outside, though, I was going to work. I was paying my bills. I wasn't showing up drunk. I wasn't showing up smelling like alcohol or literally under the influence of anything. So from the outside, people thought I was doing good. I was going to meetings. I was sharing how I had like 3 months and then 6 months. And it's like, I remember towards around the time of 6 months, because see me, if I don't have a spiritual solution, I'm looking for another solution. And I got right back into some of the things that I knew, because where I'm from, if you want to get involved, if you're living the lifestyle I'm living, and I guess it's everywhere, but it just seemed like because we were kind of closer to the border in Mexico, man, I could get as much weed as I wanted anytime I wanted. And I got right back into selling bud. And seeing I wasn't smoking it, so I'm like, well, this will just benefit me financially because I'm not going to use it. I'm going to AA, right? You know? I'm sober, even though I'm not sober, you know? I'm picking up chips, and I'm not saying I'm selling weed to the guys at the meetings, but I mean, you know, I'm doing what I do. And I ran into somebody, just how it happens. This guy's like, hey, man, I got a bunch of these pain pills. I can't take them all. Bam. I remember that pain pill worked. You know, that is an excuse. And then I had a tooth removed, and so I had justification because I actually had a pill bottle. You know, I ran out of it that day when I took them because there was only like 20 in there. But but I could actually carry these with me, and if somebody asked, or if my drug test came back positive, look, I have justification. I have a pain pill bottle. And this guy was giving me like 100 pills at a time to trade for some weed, and I'm just like, and I mean, within from 6 to 9 months, I'm taking 10 to 15 of these things a day, that you know, the tens, and looking for more. And when I try to stop, I'm getting physically sick. Like, sick. Am I still good to keep going? Okay. What? How long? Okay, I'll try to get through this, but sitting outside of my meeting to get 9 months, I broke up two pain pills on this new Bible that I got because I just tried to go back to church, and then the cover was so new that these two oblong pills made an indention on them, and I still have this Bible that I get to look at and have a reminder, you know. And I snorted those two pills, walked into this meeting, got my 9 month chip, shared how I was happy, joyous, and free, and I don't know if there was white shit on my nose or not, you know. And and the sad thing is there was people in those meetings that believed me, because I'm really good at telling people what they want to hear. So I'm coming up on a year sober on September 11th, which, by the way, is my oldest son's birthday. That was my original sobriety date, supposed sobriety date. And I ran out of pills, and I got sick, and I made this conscious decision that I'm going to drink again, and I'm going to drink, and I'm going to restart my sobriety date. I'm going to tell my sponsor. I'm going to go right back to a meeting, and I'm going to not tell him anything about the pain pills that I've been doing. So I'm not going to get honest. And when I pick up alcohol, I hadn't had it for almost a full year. you know, this disease is progressive, right where I left off. I actually made the plan the night before. I was laying next to my youngest son in bed, and I took them to school because I had gotten some visitation back because on the outside things were okay. And I dropped him off at school, and I went to the store and see, and I'm going to AA, so I'm nervous as shit about buying alcohol because somebody's going to see me. And I bought Bud Ice, which I don't drink, but I just wanted to grab something, and I bought the vodka, and I bought Gatorade, and I poured out that vodka just driving maybe 5 to 7 minutes to my house, and I had probably drank that pint within that time because, I mean, it's right where I left it off. And I was insanely drunk for about the next week. I visited the ER 3 times. All 3 times were on my own behalf. I went there because I wanted to stop. One real significant thing, my sponsor, my mom actually reached out to him and told him, you need to go fix my son because he's drinking again. And my sponsor is, man, he's hardcore. Like, he knows the big book and he knows what this program is and what the disease is. And he showed up and I had a beer in my hand and he said, are you done? And I said, nope. He said, I'll see you later. Let me know when you are. Because he knows damn well he can't do anything for me. And man, that is one of the biggest things for me today that I get to look at, because if I sponsor somebody, I can tell them the same shit. Once I put alcohol in me, I'm not the same guy, you know. And there's no talking sense into me at that point. You know, give me a little time from it and maybe. But anyway, so 3 visits to the ER, 1 visit back to Sunrise. I'll try to skip through a little bit of it. But what happened was I got out and I was going to go right back to AA. I manipulated my way through that Sunrise unit. I told them what they wanted to hear. I freaking did exactly what I'm good at doing. I lied my way through it, and I went right back to AA, and nothing changed, and I was on pain pills within like a week from that again, and within that time, I was already like right back to where I was, square one again, and about a month into it, I just finally got the gift of desperation. I hit my knees. I poured the pain pills out because, see, they weren't working anymore. I had no solution anymore. The drugs weren't working. The alcohol wasn't working. I was fucking miserable. When I closed my eyes, the images that I got were black and dark, and I forgot to a little part, but during those 3 times of going back to the hospital, there was a point where I gave up, and I'm like, I got a gun out of my safe, and I put that gun in my mouth, and see, for me, I'm a gun guy. I've always been a hunter, and I like guns, and I picked the gun that was going to go into the evidence that wasn't going to take away from what my kids were going to get handed down, and I picked the room that they weren't going to have to see when they walked through the house, you know, like. And I put that gun in my mouth, and I remember that fucking metal on my teeth, and it's just like, and I was drunk, like I was not coherent, but I didn't do it, you know, and I don't remember how I felt at that time, but I just know that I'm so grateful today that I have a God that took care of me through then. Went to the hospital, got out of Sunrise, got to the point where I was miserable, got on my knees, poured the pain pills out, told God, look, I can't live life like this anymore. It's not about the drugs and alcohol. I've put those down. I can't stay stopped off those, but I need help. And my dad presented me with the opportunity to come back to Austin Recovery because he said there was something different about me when I got out the first time. And let me tell you, I came in here. I was laying on the floorboard of my dad's truck. It's actually the truck I'm driving today out there. It was brand new when he bought it, and his first big trip was to Austin to drop me off back at rehab. Almost 2 years in a row. I was laying on the floorboard, and I was shaking because I was withdrawing, and I remember thinking to myself, if I don't tell the fucking truth, I'm going to die. If I don't get real, I'm going to die. That desperation that I hit was like, I got to do this thing. I got to go all in. I don't have a fucking choice anymore. And even if my kids don't ever want me back, if they take my house, if they take everything from me, so what? Without sobriety, I have nothing. You know, I've already lost it all so many times. And I got to Austin Recovery again, and I got real. I put pen to paper. I talked to my sponsor. He was still willing to work with me. He said, there's just no more bullshit. I got out of here. I went through the same stuff that they taught me the first time, you know. The only thing that changed is I was fucking willing to do whatever it takes now. And when I got out of here, man, I haven't looked back. I did my 4-step. I sat down with my sponsor and his sponsor, and I did my 5th step. Not an easy thing to do, but I guarantee, you know, that set me on the path to where I could finally forgive myself because I got clean about all this shit that I've been holding on to my whole life. Early on, after realizing that my sobriety was the most important thing in my life, I got involved in service work. So, like some of the things that I want to share about today, you know, because I'm supposed to share about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. You know, through all that, it was what it was like. What happened is I got desperate enough to try to do something different. And through the process of the 12 steps, I have a relationship with a God that I can do business with on a daily basis. A God that will carry me through anything that I go through, no matter what. And what I'm like today is I am an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm involved in service work. I have a service position for our district. I actually am part of the Young People's Advisory Council in New Mexico. We have a Nim Kippah next weekend, and I'm going to be the main speaker on Sunday morning, which scares the shit out of me, but, you know, it is what it is. I have a home group. We do a big book study, and we're actually a young people's group. And even in where I'm from, man, there's not a lot of young people, but we do what we do, and we stay in the solution. I have a sponsor that I talk to. I have guys that I sponsor. I sit down and I read this book because, see, what I have today is I have a solution. I have the tools of my story, my experience, strength, and hope that I can share with somebody else so they can identify. And then I have this thing here that I didn't believe in, this thing that has given me a life that I don't fucking deserve, this thing that I finally said, fuck it, I'm all in because I don't want to die. And I did it to the best of my ability with what I had to offer at that time, which wasn't a lot. Because I'm still finding out more about myself, you know? And through this process of fucking doing things like this that are so uncomfortable, I've turned into a guy that I can actually look at in the mirror and say, man, it's cool. I love you today, you know? Like, and I get to show up in their life. And like, and you know, and it's like, I can have this relationship with their mom, or, I mean, shit, we talk sometimes for 20 or 30 minutes without even realizing it. And this was somebody that I blamed everything on. The one little quick story. When I got sober, I still have my driver's license, right? They hadn't done anything in California yet. My license expired September, I think it was actually September 11th of year before last. I went down there to renew it a week before, and they're like, nope, California's got a hold. So it took me, and I'm just going to tell you this, if you go all in on this thing and you apply the principles of this program to any area of your life, you can get through anything. I've been driving around on an expired license. It's not revoked or suspended, but it's been expired, and that still scares the shit out of me, for a year and 9 months. And just 2 weeks ago, I just got my driver's license back. You know, and it was not an easy process. This is like constant calls, $5,000 for an attorney over in California. I mean, I don't know how much time I spent on the phone with the California MVD trying to get some of this stuff resolved. But patience and tolerance are a fucking virtue, you know. I am grateful today that I can say that if I would have done it my way, I would have showed up in California and demanded things. Because, see, what happened was I was already sober. And I expected them to understand that I'm already living different. You can't expect me to do this shit that I'm already doing, you know? But through this process, man, I got to actually let go. And I turned this thing over to God. And the day that I got my license, don't get me wrong, I was excited. But it was just another day, you know? It's just another day. And it's just another thing that I get to share with somebody else. It's like, man, you can make it through anything. My sobriety is the most important thing in my life today. It comes before my kids, it comes before my job, it comes before my relationship, it comes before anything that I've got. Because as soon as I put it second, I'm going to lose everything. You know, and if it scares you to think about putting your kids or anything else second, don't. Because everything that I have in my life is fucking first class. Because my sobriety is first. You know, this sobriety that I have today is a gift from God. And I truly believe, you know, that it is my responsibility to give this gift back, because I can't keep it if I don't. So what I do with this gift is my gift back to God. You know, man, I'm really glad to be here. If you guys got anything out of this, I hope it's just some hope, because this thing truly works. But you got to let go, man. You got to get desperate enough to do some things that are really uncomfortable. But I can sit here and say that my life is a direct result of working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and through these 12 steps. And thanks for letting me share.